As I was saying 12 years ago when I was interrupted, good afternoon. I want to welcome everyone to this panel's first hearing. We have a very active agenda planned for the subcommittee, and I am pleased to be sitting next to my good friend, Fred Upton, as we begin this process. We will try to retain the same level of comity that existed when he was the chairman. I believe that is the way the telecommunications issues should be conducted. Today we begin with legislation that was unanimously approved by the committee and the House in the last Congress when it was sponsored by former Chairman Joe Barton and my committee colleague, Congressman Elliot Engel from New York. They have teamed up again this year and reintroduce the bill, and today we hope to gather updated testimony and approve the bill through the subcommittee. This legislation addresses caller ID spoofing. Spoofing is when a caller masks or changes the caller ID information of their call in a way that disguises the true origination number of the caller. In many instances, a call recipient may be subject to pretexting through spoofing, which can lead to fraud, personal ID theft, harassment, or otherwise put the safety of the call recipient in danger. It is important that we explore and analyze the use of spoofing to commit crimes and otherwise harm the public interest. On the other hand, lest we think that spoofing always has nefarious aims, we must recognize that there may be circumstances when a person's safety may be put in danger if their true and accurate call origination information is disclosed as well. What we seek in caller ID policy is balance. This has been the case since we held hearings in the early 1990s on caller ID, when this subcommittee sought to take into account emerging caller ID technology in a way that also allowed callers to block their origination number on a per-call or per-line basis. Technology also allowed call recipients to refuse to receive calls by anyone who is blocking their caller ID information from going through. Last year, we adjusted the legislation to ensure achieved historic balance so that we look at consumer privacy and security. For instance, members of Congress often have direct lines in their offices. In order to ensure that such lines do not become generally public and therefore remain useful to us, it may be necessary to keep such direct numbers confidential and have the outgoing caller ID information indicate a different number at which our offices can be reached to return calls. That gives the recipient a legitimate phone number to call back, but keeps confidential lines private. There are many doctors, psychiatrists, lawyers, and other professionals who would similarly like to keep direct, confidential lines private in this way, who have no intention of misleading anyone. In addition, there may be instances, for example, when a woman at a shelter seeks to reach her children at home, when spoofing is important to safeguard someone's safety. Moreover, informants to law enforcement tip lines or whistleblowers have additional reasons for why their calling information should remain private. We should not outlaw any of these practices, and if the legislation that we are now considering needed clarification, we have now put that clarification in so that spoofing is put into context, that we address those areas where the intent is to actually defraud or harass a call party. That's the goal of the legislation. Again, I want to commend my colleagues, Joe Barton and Elliot Engel, for their great work. And I now turn to recognize my good friend, the gentleman from Michigan, Mr. Upton.
I thank the chairman, and I, too, look forward to working with you over the next 2 years before we get to get the gavel back over here. But take good care of it. You can see that we did. In the last 12 years, a lot of chips in this thing. It's well-worn, but I appreciate certainly your leadership and efforts to convene today's hearing and then mark up a little bit later when this hearing is over. And I'm going to ask that my full statement be put into the record, and I'm not going to say give the definition of spoofing. You did a very good job. This is a bipartisan bill, And I'll remind my colleagues that it passed by voice last year in the House, on the House floor. Sadly, the Senate did not take it up, otherwise it would have been a public law. And I commend Mr. Barton again, and certainly my good friend Mr. Engel, for their continued leadership on this very important issue. Let me just convey a couple of different instances where spoofing was used, which clearly shows the need for this legislation. AARP alerted its members to a prevalent scam where spoofers get the local courthouse phone number to appear on people's, on folks' caller ID screens, and then they tell the recipients of the calls that they're judicial officials in order to get that victim's personal information, whether it be a Social Security number, driver's license, etc. Another reported case involving a SWAT team that surrounded an apartment building after police received a call from a woman who said she was being held hostage in one of those apartments. As it turned out, it was a false alarm. Caller ID was spoofed to make it look like it was coming from that apartment, someone's idea of a bad prank. In other instances, criminals are stealing credit card numbers, getting the phone number of the actual cardholder, and then using those credit cards to get unauthorized wire transfers, PIN numbers, a whole host of things that damage that individual's personal information, a real violation. And of course, many of us are familiar with our own credit card companies, which may ask us to call from home phones to authenticate and then activate that new card. And if the cards are stolen out of the mail, then criminals may be able to spoof our home phone numbers and authenticate and activate that new card from the convenience of their home or motel room or for whatever rock they might crawl under. Unfortunately, spoofing does appear to be growing, and there is no law that protects the American public from it. This legislation, the Truth in Caller ID Act, would make it illegal. More specifically, it would make it unlawful for any person to cause any caller identification service to transmit misleading or inaccurate caller identification information with the intent to defraud or cause harm. The unfortunate reality is that our age of information has resulted in an explosion of identity theft. And while new technologies have provided us with tremendous advancements and benefits, technology has also provided great opportunities to criminals as well. I look forward to hearing from our witnesses today and for the markup, and I would like to think that we could move this to the House floor soon with the gentleman's leadership from Massachusetts. I yield back my time.
I thank the gentleman. Gentleman from Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this bill has been well introduced, so in my first official action as vice chairman of your subcommittee.
And by the way, I would like to make that public announcement to all the members that the gentleman from Pennsylvania, Mr. Doyle, is going to serve as a supremely competent and knowledgeable vice chairman of this committee.
Well said, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'm going to follow your lead from earlier this morning, Mr. Chairman, and waive my opening statement so we can get to our spokes.
Thank you. Let me then recognize the gentleman from New York, the author of this legislation, Mr. Engel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I will submit my statement for the record, but I just want to make a couple of comments. First, thank you. I'm truly honored that you are taking this bill at our first hearing and markup, and I really appreciate it. When it became clear to me about the problems of spoofing, I went over to then Chairman Barton and asked him if we could do this bill, and so we submitted the bill in the last Congress as a Barton-Engel bill. But due to the changes, I like the way it is submitted in this Congress as the Engel-Barton bill, and I thank my good friend for co-sponsoring it again this year, as well as Chairman Upton for supporting it. We held hearings on this bill last year, and the statement that you made, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Upton's statements really, capsulize what the hearings told us, the fact that there are instances where we may not want the real number to show, and that there are many horror stories that we know, and it can go, on and on in terms of political campaigns and trickery where people from one campaign can pretend they're calling from the opposition's campaign and do all kinds of things to get voters angry at the opposition. So this is truly a bill whose time has come, and I'm very grateful that we have a tremendous consensus, and I'm going to submit this, and I look forward to hearing the testimony and doing the markup with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And yeah, this is the 20th anniversary this month of my becoming chairman of this subcommittee 20 years ago. So it's an honor for me to have this bill be the first bill that on the 20th anniversary that we'll be processing. Gentleman from Illinois.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Congratulations. And I'm glad you brought up that there are some beneficial uses. I kind of forgot about when people call us on our cell phones member to member, we have it's a different number that pops up on our cell phones, even in this system. So we all want to go after the bad actors, but there are some credible positive uses, and we want to maintain that balance. I think you'll try to do that. I appreciate your efforts, and I yield back my time.
Thank you. Gentlelady from California.
Thank you, and congratulations to you, Mr. Chairman, and also for bringing this very timely piece of legislation forward. I'll just submit my statement for the record, but just want to tell you that as a longtime advocate on domestic violence issues, I'm pleased to see that the legislation helps to clarify that law to protect those victims. So thank you very much, and I'll submit my statement for the record. Yield back.
Okay, great. Gentleman from Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually thought when I saw something about spoofing on our list today that it had more to do with the chairman, full committee chairman's comment about DTV yesterday and maybe changing the date. But since it's on this, I really don't have an opening statement. I supported this bill last time, and I'll look forward to supporting it again.
Gentleman from Nebraska.
I'll wave.
Excellent.
The anniversary, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much. I was a young man once long ago. Let us now turn to our incredibly impressive panel of witnesses. That would be Ms. Allison Knight, staff attorney from the Electronic Privacy Information Center. She is staff counsel at that organization, a graduate of the University of Western Ontario. She has written extensively on this subject, and we appreciate very much your being here. We have Ms. Stacy Pies, who is vice president of Point and Point One president, testifying on behalf of the Vaughan Coalition. She has 15 years of experience in communications, legal, and regulatory experience, and she also served at the FCC as deputy division chief in the Network Services Division and senior attorney in the FCC's Common Carrier Bureau. Ms. Chris Monteith, chief of the FCC Enforcement Bureau. She is the chief of that bureau. She has held numerous jobs at the FCC, including overseeing the commission's interaction with local, state, and tribal governments. She has also served as the chief of policy for the Wireless Telecommunications Bureau and Deputy Chief of the former Common Carrier Bureau's Competitive Pricing Division. So I think what we'll do is we'll recognize the witnesses in the order that I introduced them, and then we'll finish up with the FCC giving us their summary view of this issue. So, Ms. Knight, you have 5 minutes. Please begin.
Can you hear me now? Chairman Markey, Ranking Member Upton, and members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on caller ID spoofing and H.R. 251, the Truth in Caller ID Act of 2007. My name is Allison Knight, and I'm staff counsel and director of the Privacy and Human Rights Project at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. EPIC is a nonpartisan research organization based in Washington that seeks to focus public attention on emerging civil liberties issues and to protect privacy, the First Amendment, and constitutional values. I'd like to discuss two separate and important privacy interests related to the issue of caller ID spoofing. The first is the right of callers to limit the disclosure of their phone numbers in order to protect their privacy and, in some cases, their safety. The second is the right for call recipients to be free from pretexting and other fraud that can lead to the loss of their privacy and the threats of stalking, identity theft, and harassment. Before caller ID services were offered, telephone customers generally had the ability to control the circumstances under which their phone numbers were disclosed to others. Many individuals have legitimate reasons to report a different number than the one presented on caller ID, as was remarked in the opening comments. For example, a person may wish to keep their direct line private when making phone calls from within an organization. And in some circumstances, disclosure of a person's telephone number may also put his or her safety at risk. Domestic violence survivors, shelters, and other safe homes need to preserve their confidentiality of their phone numbers. They may need to contact abusers without exposing their location in order to arrange custody or other legitimate matters. They also may need to contact other third parties, such as businesses, that may have very permissive privacy policies and would then share collected telephone numbers with lists or data brokers. In all of these situations, preserving anonymity is necessary for their safety. Caller ID blocking may seem like a viable means for allowing callers to protect their anonymity while not misleading recipients. However, caller ID blocking is not a complete solution. A caller can be identified through other means, such as the automatic number identification system. And some recipients prevent receiving blocked calls, and indications are that numbers of individuals who are doing this is growing. In the case of a domestic violence survivor attempting to safely reach a required phone number, an individual would have to use spoofing for the innocent purpose of preserving the confidentiality of his or her number. We also can't ignore the privacy interests of those who decline to accept calls from unknown numbers. If an individual has habitually received harassment calls from a caller ID blocked number, we should not permit the harasser to use spoofing as a means to circumvent the individual's screening. Caller ID spoofing can also create privacy risks. Last year, Epic brought to Congress's attention the problem of pretexting consumers' phone records. Pretexting is a technique by which a bad actor can obtain an individual's personal information by impersonating a trusted entity. For these reasons, the practice of spoofing for the purpose of fraud or harm should be curtailed. Preventing spoofing for harmful reasons will also hold illegitimate spoofers accountable. Spoofing caller ID numbers can create a real risk to individuals who might be defrauded or harmed by illegitimate uses of the technology. At the same time, it's important not to punish those who have a legitimate reason to conceal their actual telephone numbers. EPIC supports Bill H.R. 251 as currently drafted because, including an intent requirement, the Truth in Caller ID Act of 2007 distinguishes between appropriate and inappropriate caller ID spoofing and also preserves legitimate law enforcement techniques. Finally, we'd also like to call the subcommittee's attention to our ongoing concern about the revelation that the National Security Agency may have constructed a massive database of telephone records of American consumers. We again ask members to support EPIC's recommendation that the FCC undertake an investigation of the possibly improper disclosure of telephone records by telephone companies that are subject to the privacy obligations contained in the Communications Act. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Pies.
Thank you, Chairman Markey.
Can you push the button there right in front of you?
My name is Stacey Pies. I am Vice President of Point One, a VOIP provider, and President of the Voice on the Net, or VON Coalition, the voice for the VOIP industry. Misleading people through the misuse of caller ID, whether for a prank, a scam, or worse, is unacceptable. And on behalf of the VON Coalition, I thank the committee for its leadership in addressing this issue. VOIP is burgeoning in popularity with businesses and consumers because it can do so much more than plain old telephone service. VOIP allows consumers to take control over their communications experience, to manage how they use those services, and to decide when and where they receive calls. Lower costs, coupled with a seemingly endless list of new possibilities, are making VOIP one of the hottest internet and broadband technologies today. Today's VOIP services aren't simply a means to have a conversation. They're portals to a world of information that enriches the communications experience and adds new dimensions to the idea of a conversation. Studies have shown that with the right policy framework and continued advancement, VOIP-driven competition has the potential to save consumers more than $100 billion over the next 5 years. For businesses, VOIP is lowering costs, increasing mobility, enabling collaboration, integrating voice and data in entirely new ways, boosting productivity, and giving companies a competitive advantage. And the best is yet ahead. Many of the great benefits of VOIP to consumers and business users depends on accurate and non-misleading identification of the calling party. If I program my VOIP service to ensure that calls for my son's school are simultaneously rung on all of my phones, I don't want to answer it and find out that some telemarketer has spoofed the number to fool me into believing it is a priority call. To protect the usefulness of their services, VOIP providers have a strong interest in having caller ID be accurate and non-misleading. The Vaughn Coalition has been at the forefront of promoting best practices to enable consumers to protect their personal data, moving early to adopt and post consumer guidelines for protecting billing records. Since then, businesses that control personal data, consumers, and the IP industry have taken significant steps to self-police fraudulent access to personal data. The Vaughn Coalition agrees with previously presented congressional testimony that caller ID fraud perpetrators must be penalized. Law enforcement should have the tools to protect U.S. citizens from individuals that fraudulently manipulate phone numbers to commit a crime against the person or a crime against property. Spoofing to defraud or harass or for unlawful commercial gain cannot and should not ever be condoned or tolerated. Congress is right to focus its attention on those who would do so. As this committee addresses deceptive spoofing, we urge you to continue to carefully balance the goal of thwarting criminal behavior with the public interest imperative to ensure that innovation flourishes and that applications and services delivered over broadband are available to all Americans. As Chairman Markey so eloquently described in his opening statement, the ability of consumers to control various aspects of their communication experience presents exciting opportunities for the disabled, offers unsurpassed privacy protection, and enables businesses and consumers to communicate in increasingly efficient and powerful ways. The Truth in Caller ID Act, with the focus on the intent to commit fraud or other crimes, effectively balances these two important objectives by facilitating prosecution while not thwarting or prohibiting innovative tools that have legitimate consumer empowering benefits. The bill recognizes that caller identification information may be modified for telemarketers to comply with the TCPA. This is not the only legitimate need to change caller ID. I'd like to share five examples. First, VOIP services offer tremendous potential for persons with disabilities to communicate more effectively. One recent web application permits users to call any phone number in the U.S. or Canada, and the service reads to the called party the message that the originating user inputs into a web-based form. Users of the application who are speech impaired can now send voice messages. Similarly, blind users can now take advantage of instant messaging services where previously they would have been precluded from doing so because of sight limitations. Second, one of the benefits of VOIP is to help consumers better protect their own privacy. For instance, websites that allow consumers to post solicitations for lawful commercial purposes may also permit consumers to provide a temporary callback number that's different from their assigned number. One service explains the application in this way: the desire to communicate cannot be crippled by privacy. This application unleashes the true potential of the global community by making it a safer place. Third, as recognized by Chairman Markey and Ms. Knight, there are some situations in which caller ID information can actually endanger individual safety. The classic situation is the battered spouse. In some instances, blocking the delivery of caller ID information might be sufficient. However, because technological innovations also facilitate the unblocking of caller ID, any legislation should be careful about presuming that blocking will always be adequate protection. Fourth, certain new communication services do not organically generate or transmit caller ID. But in order to connect to the public telephone network, the service may need to insert something that looks like a traditional phone number. Many of these innovative services, which offer tremendous ways to communicate, do not utilize the same numbering and labeling practices as yesterday's phone services and should not be deemed illegitimate because of this. A final exciting new application is the ability for consumers to make click-to-dial calls while viewing broadband-based content. utilizing such an application, a viewer can click a single button on her standard remote and pull up a menu that offers a variety of products and services, including contacting her local member of Congress. The constituent can locate the contact information for the member's office and then click on a button that enables her to reach the office through a VoIP connection.
Excellent job.
Excellent
job.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We wanted you to get through all five of those. Ms. Monteith.
Good afternoon, Chairman Markey, Ranking Member Upton, and members of the subcommittee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about the problem of caller identification spoofing. As you know, caller ID services let customers identify who is calling them by displaying the caller's telephone number or other information on the customer's equipment before the customer picks up the phone. Caller ID spoofing refers to a practice in which the caller ID information transmitted with a telephone call is manipulated in a manner that misleads the call recipient about the identity of the caller. The Commission is deeply concerned about reports that caller ID information is being manipulated for fraudulent or other deceptive purposes and the impact of those practices on the public trust and confidence in the telecommunications industry. We are particularly concerned about how this practice may affect consumers, as well as public safety and law enforcement communities. As a technical matter, caller ID spoofing happens by manipulating the data elements that travel with a phone call. Phone calls on the public switch telephone network, or the PSTN, are routed to their destinations by means of a specialized protocol called the Signaling System 7, or SS7. SS7 conveys information associated with a call, such as the telephone number of the caller. The SS7 information for a call is provided by the carrier that the caller uses to place the call. Caller ID then displays that caller's number to the called party. Caller ID spoofing is accomplished by manipulating the SS7 information associated with the call. The Commission addressed caller ID on the PSTN in 1995 with Rule 64.1601, which generally requires all carriers using SS7 to transmit the calling party number associated with an interstate call to interconnecting carriers. The same Commission rule also requires telemarketers to transmit accurate caller ID information. The development of internet and IP technologies has made caller ID spoofing easier than it used to be. Now, entities using IP technology can generate false calling party information and pass it into the PSTN via SS7. Caller ID spoofing can potentially threaten our public safety. For example, spoofers can fabricate emergency calls and cause local law enforcement and public safety agencies to deploy their resources needlessly. Caller ID spoofing also can potentially threaten consumers. Spoofing can be used, for example, by the unscrupulous to defraud consumers by making calls appear as if they are from legitimate businesses or government offices. The Commission's Enforcement Bureau has been actively investigating the issue of caller ID spoofing since the summer of 2005, when information regarding junk fax spoofing came to our attention. To date, the Bureau has initiated investigations of 12 companies engaged in the marketing and selling of caller ID spoofing services to customers. One investigation resulted in a citation against a telemarketer, Intelligent Alternatives, for rule violations, including violations of the caller ID rules under Section 64.1601. We have sent formal letters of inquiry to the other companies and at the same time served most of them with subpoenas to compel them to respond to our inquiries. In some cases, we have issued subsequent letters of inquiry to uncover additional evidence of possible violations of the Communications Act. Our inquiry letters seek information about the company's alleged spoofing methods, including detailed technical explanations and the types of technologies utilized, the identity of other companies that assist in providing the spoofing services, the purpose for the services and information about subscribers, and whether the offered services can be used to spoof emergency services information or otherwise affect those critical first responders. We continue to seek relevant information to assist us in fully understanding these issues and whether violations of the Communications Act or our rules have occurred, but our enforcement options may be limited by some of these entities who are not directly regulated by the Commission. At the same time, we've held meetings with numerous industry representatives, including wireline, wireless, and voice over internet protocol-based companies, to determine the impact of caller ID spoofing on their consumers and networks. In addition, we have coordinated closely with state agencies, the Federal Trade Commission, and other interested organizations, such as the National Emergency Number Association, regarding their efforts to address and identify solutions to this problem. The Enforcement Bureau is committed to continuing to gather and analyze information about these companies' practices, their networks, their businesses, their customers, and other germane information. In conclusion, the intentional manipulation of caller ID information, especially for the purpose of fraud or deception, is a troubling development in the telecommunications industry. The Commission looks forward to working with Congress, this committee, to ensure that the public maintains its confidence in the telecommunications industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. We thank each of the witnesses. That now concludes the time for testimony by our witnesses. And now the chair will recognize himself for a question of the witnesses. Ms. Knight, do you feel that the changes that have been made in the legislation take into account the context of the call so that now the bill goes after the bad actors without hindering legitimate uses of technology?
Yes, the intent requirement the intent that would either to defraud or to cause harm adequately and rightly covers the illegitimate uses and still protects the legitimate uses of caller ID spoofing.
Okay, great. Well, I have no other questions. Gentlemen.
Does the FTC want to respond to that same? Do you think it addresses everything that we should in this bill?
Yes, and I think what would be important with respect to intent is that Congress and the committee provide as much in the way of legislative history as possible to inform the Commission of the applicable standard under the intent standard.
Okay. I have no further questions. Thank
Great.
You.
Great. Gentleman from New York, Mr. Engel.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Monteith, in your testimony, you mentioned that the commissions coordinated with state agencies regarding the efforts of the state agencies to identify solutions to this problem. Can you give some examples of what the states are doing to solve the problems?
I know we've worked closely with the Florida Attorney General's office and I believe with members of the NARUC. I don't have any specific examples. We do participate with NARUC members on a monthly call that's aimed at addressing consumer protection types of issues, but I'd be happy to get specific details and respond to your question.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. Ms. Pies, I want to, and you gave a lot of good examples of this new, the new technology. The VOIP providers, it's really exciting, and obviously many people use these things. My kids can tell you more about them than I can. But there's no standard. Is that true for VOIP providers when it comes to caller ID?
If I understand the question, you're asking whether there's an industry-wide accepted technical standard for transmission of caller ID.
Yes.
There are several different protocols that are used to provide VOIP services. Really depends on the type of service that's being provided, the type of network, whether or not it's connecting to the PSTN. And there are practices that some providers use. As Chris explained in her testimony, if you are connecting with the PSTN, there are different requirements in order to be able to pass if you're utilizing SS7 based signaling, there's different information that has to be passed. Some providers where calls originate IP rather than originating on the PSTN, as I described in my testimony, don't the networks don't organically generate a caller ID that is what we think of in the traditional plain old telephone service world. So they may, for instance, insert a number such as 0001234 in order to allow the call to connect. But that call doesn't have a traditional phone number associated with it.
Do most programs let someone manually enter any caller ID info that they want?
I can't answer whether most do or don't. What VOIP does that is so empowering for businesses and consumers is it essentially moves functionality that used to be in the hands of the large companies. So, for instance, setting up a PBX system. I can now download software and set up a PBX system from my home, and I can serve a small business straight from my home. I don't have to contract through Verizon. So the ability to do that also enables me to control some of the functionalities that the phone company would have controlled in the past, such as establishing the caller ID. I know that there are a number of consumer or residential VOIP services that ask the consumer to select a phone number and fix that selection from the get-go, and the caller does not have the ability to manipulate it as they go on.
Is the industry working towards any standard that you know on how to handle things so that things would be uniform?
The industry is, as far as I know, and you know, there are technical organizations and engineers that may be working on issues that I'm not aware of, establishing a caller ID so that calls look like plain old telephone service is probably not high on the priority list. Most of the industry standards that are being worked on allow the old network to communicate with the next generation network, and sort of making up a caller ID parameter so that it looks like an old phone call doesn't serve any beneficial purpose when the networks can talk to each other without that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Shimbikas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to follow up on this range. There's always unintended consequences when we move legislation, and it struck me that we've defined that there's legitimate reasons to spoof for protection. We've been involved a lot with the 911 issue and enhanced 911 and identification location. Is there a concern, especially with VoIP, which is we're not totally deployed, we're still having issues with how if someone uses the VoIP service and they call 911, how do we know where they're at? And we're trying to push that out. Let's take someone who is spoofing legitimately to protect their location. What if they then try to make an emergency service call? Are they in the system or are they not? Can they be identified or can they not be identified, either using traditional landline, cellular, or VoIP? Is this something we need to talk through, or am I just not technologically knowledgeable enough to say it's not an issue?
I'd like to answer.
Yeah.
That's a very good question. And actually, the way that a VOIP caller or a cellular caller contacts the right PSAP, the correct PSAP for the location where the person is located, is there's a system called PANI or pseudo automatic number identification. And that number is input into a database or a server so that when my call goes in, for instance, I have a 202 number in my office in Maryland. My call will go into the 911 system. And because we have a very old 911 system that actually doesn't work particularly efficiently, you have to fool the system to letting it believe that the call is coming from the right geographic location. So there is a pseudo ante that is associated then with my call that tells the PSAP that I am in Maryland as opposed to DC. So in fact, though that is a legitimate spoofing capability that needs to be protected to enable the 911 call to go to the right PSAP. It is not something that needs to be prevented, because both mobile calls or VOIP calls, any type of service that can be used from a different location from what a traditional phone service would be used, needs to have that sort of pseudo phone number to be able to tell the PSAP where to go and which PSAP to answer.
So no matter what number you change it to, or the identification, the pseudo ante number, it will direct you to the location?
Correct.
Great. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Gentleman from Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Monteith, first of all, it looks like this bill we have here in the subcommittee is a slam dunk, and we appreciate your help in the process. I just thought while we have you here, I'd like to have you tell us how an enforcement action happens. Walk us through it, and do you start it? Does the chairman's office start it? Tell us how it works.
Sure. An enforcement action can be initiated through a number of different procedures. One may be that we would investigate an issue that comes to our attention that's troubling and may be a violation of the Communications Act. Secondly, we certainly could be asked by the chairman, other commissioners, the Hill, to investigate issues. And thirdly, we're very often complaint-driven. A complaint is filed with the commission alleging a violation of the Communications Act, and we investigate to ensure that there is not, or to determine that there is. Once we initiate an investigation, our general fact-finding process is to send letters of inquiry to the subject of our investigation, asking them to provide us with information concerning the underlying issues. They are compelled to respond. If they're a non-regulated entity, we sometimes serve a subpoena, as well as issuing the formal letter of inquiry to ensure that they will respond to our inquiry. From there, if our investigation reveals that there has been a violation of the Communications Act, our general process with respect to a regulated entity is to issue what we call a notice of apparent liability. That is a finding that we believe there's been a violation. And we propose, in many instances, a forfeiture along with that finding. The entity then has an opportunity to respond to us and indicate to us that either factually or legally, do not understand the case or the facts before us, the law before us. From there, we go to a forfeiture order. That may be different at times from our original notice of apparent liability, depending on what has been presented to us by the entity in its response to the notice of apparent liability. If we're dealing with a non-regulated entity or an entity that doesn't have an application or a license or a permit from the commission, before we can go to the notice of apparent liability stage, we're required by statute to issue a citation. And before we could then go to the notice of apparent liability stage and impose a forfeiture or a fine, we would have to find a repeat violation by that same entity of the same underlying Communications Act provision or our rules. So that's, in essence, the process.
When would the chairman or other commissioners get involved in an enforcement action, or do they ever?
Involved with respect to asking us to investigate, or involved in the investigation?
In the investigation.
The Bureau, of course, would coordinate with the chairman's office and with the commissioners to share information about our investigations. And depending upon whether the investigation is something that the Bureau could handle on delegated authority, or whether we had to present the item for the commission's full consideration. The commissioners may be more or less involved in the investigation. Certainly, if it's an item that's being presented to the commission for vote, the Bureau would be responding to the commissioners and the chairman and the kinds of questions that they may have to assure themselves that they are, they fully understand the facts and the law surrounding the investigation.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Gentleman from Oregon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really don't have any questions. I think they've been well addressed, and look forward to moving into the market.
Beautiful. Gentleman from Nebraska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I only have one question. It's the same one that I asked last time, and I think we made sure that this appropriate use was protected, and that's within our teleservices industry, two of the top three of which are headquartered in my district. So I just want to ask Chris if you could verify that from your reading that a teleservices company that uses their client's name and number as the caller ID number is an accepted practice and is not one that would be considered defrauding or harming.
Yes, I believe that's correct under our rules.
That would be our intent. Thank you.
Wait. Yield back. With the gentleman yielding back, there are the time for questions by the members of the subcommittee has expired. That concludes the hearing. All members have 10 days if they wish to submit questions to the witnesses, and the committee clerk will notify the members as to how that process works. And without objection, this subcommittee is now adjourned. And we will now have the meeting once again. Okay, so all the witnesses, if you would like, we thank you so much for your excellent testimony. And we'll take a 1 minute break while we clear the table and we put our counsel down there. Gino, would you like to ask a question?
Well, I had some questions to the SEC, Mr. Chairman. I thought I had a few minutes. I thought I was 10 minutes away because we had Michael's ahead of me and another Republican.
The rest of the members were very unexpectedly briefer than historically has been the case. So we understand, and a unanimous request that everything that I've said for the preceding 3 minutes regarding the cessation of committee business in the hearing phase is now expunged from the record. We will move back to the point at which Mr. Terry has just yielded back the balance of his time. Objection, that will be the course of business. And we'll recognize the gentleman from Texas, Mr. Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your courtesies. Again, I apologize. The office just down the hall. I'm actually trying to work with the Ecuador ambassador with an energy company, and so you understand that, Mr. Chairman. but I just have some questions for Ms. Monteith. Commercial telemarketers are required to transmit accurate caller ID information that applies whether the calls are made in person or whether they're using automated calls. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so.
If a nonprofit, such as a political action committee or a political party or 571 organization, makes an automated calls to voters, does the current FCC rules prohibit them from using inaccurate caller ID info? If it's nonprofits or political campaigns?
I don't believe exempt organizations are covered under our rules.
Okay. The committee memo agrees with that and says that that there is no broad mandate, however, that the correct caller ID information be transmitted for non-commercial calls. That's the only thing. The draft bill we have today prohibits the sending of inaccurate caller ID info with the intent to defraud or cause harm. Does this language prohibit automated political calls with inaccurate caller ID info? Does that definition of with intent to defraud or cause harm, would that apply to nonprofits or political campaigns?
I would prefer to, if you don't mind, with all due respect, look at the question before I answer.
Okay. Okay, we'll be glad to submit that.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
Mr. Chairman, generally intent to defraud is relatively clear for a standard, but when you add to it intent to cause harm, it's less clear. And I would hope that the FCC would interpret that standard, which causes a harm, how much intent is it needed to qualify? And so that's an open-ended, but we'll submit that to you. And I know we have a markup set for this bill, and I'd like to, I have an amendment that will address it, but I'll hold to the full committee. But I think there's some concern about that, that I want to make sure we don't have a loophole that can be done by nonprofits or even political campaigns. Because our constituents are going to get mad when that caller ID is false, and whether it's me calling them or the Democratic Party or some, nonprofit group. Ms. Knight, your organization has been very helpful in identifying some justified reasons for allowing callers to withhold and hide caller ID info, such as people making anonymous tips to newspapers and legitimate investigations, and also women's shelters, for example. We now have an intent standard in the bill, and I'm concerned that organizations making deceptive political calls using fake caller ID information would not be covered. Is it your understanding this bill would include nonprofit or political organizations?
Well, I think that the standard of deception is different than either fraud or to cause harm. And I think that the standard that has been articulated in the bill does clearly delineate between legitimate and illegitimate uses of spoofing.
Okay. Can you think of any legitimate reason someone or some group that's making hundreds or even thousands of calls with an automated system would use a false caller ID? And this is open to anyone. I guess because I think the bill is a great bill. In fact, I know it's been both my colleague, Congressman Elliott, and Ranking Member Barton. I just worry that we're leaving maybe a loophole here that we're not going to address, and we'll have to come back at some future time.
Well, again, I think that the focus rightly is on the intent.
Okay, and not that causes harm.
Well, either the intent to defraud or to cause harm.
Okay, right? So the intent to defraud would be the primary, or to cause harm is actually an addition to it. You don't have to meet both tests.
Right, the wording of the bill has an or. I would see to defraud as being more traditional fraud, where there would be a calculable monetary damage that would be associated with it, whereas harm, I think, would be more along the lines of a physical harm to deal with some of the issues that I brought up in terms of safety.
Okay. Well, I guess the fraud issue, because if for example, the Democratic Party is only calling Republican primary voters, what would you think that would be? Would that be an attempt to defraud with their caller ID not showing it's a Democratic Party?
Well, again, I think that deception and fraud are two different standards. I won't try to make any kind of judgment on how the bill will eventually be interpreted. However, I think
we don't want anybody to interpret it. We want to put it in the language so they don't have to.
I mean, I could get you further details on this at a later date if you would like. I'd like to restate that EPIC does support the language either to intend to defraud or to cause harm. We think that adequately makes a distinction between different uses.
But again, someone could still be using robocalls just to deceive. And because defraud, they're not, I mean, except for maybe selling them an idea instead of a product.
Well, again, if that doesn't meet the language either to defraud or to cause harm, then it wouldn't be caught within the bill.
Yeah.
And it would therefore be a legitimate use.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you again.
Okay, great. And we look forward to working with the gentleman from Texas between the subcommittee and the full committee on his concerns. With that, the gentleman's time has expired. And again, all time for questions by members of the subcommittee has expired. And this portion of the hearing has concluded. We once again thank the witnesses for their excellent testimony. And we will recess for a minute while the witnesses clear the table and staff counsel can move into place so that we can begin a markup of this legislation.